the other great example is the Joe Rogan first podcast, right? If you go back 10 years, like this car wreck of a video.
It's like the first 15 minutes are like they're trying to figure out how the webcam works. And now yeah. It's got like 50, 60 million people listening. Oh, it's crazy.
Yeah. I think there's obviously a lot of forces at play. Like the size of the internet is so overwhelming that there's, you know, the amount of competition definitely does increase. But there's also just this overwhelming amount of people that don't make it very far because they don't get this instant feedback. And to go back to like the very first conversation we had, there has to be something about it that benefits you beyond who you reach or the dopamine thing that you get as a result of putting it out in the world. It's like me working on these ideas, whether or anybody sees them, is going to make me a more competent graphic designer. So is that a skill worth doing? Yes. If I share it, does it lead to other opportunities? Yes. It has to have something like foundational that it benefits you personally. You know, the whole vain thing that we're coming back to. It's like, if you get that in there, then, you know, even if nobody sees it, you're still winning.
Welcome to Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. Today's episode is a special one with Jack Butcher. He's the founder of Visualize Value. He's one of the best creative minds I've seen out there, and he's really executing at an incredible level. His account on Twitter and Instagram is called Visualize Value. He's grown that to over 100,000 people in less than 2 years. And now as a business that is bringing in over $100,000 per month with 99% profit margins. In our chat, we talk about building an audience from scratch in 2020 and beyond, transitioning from selling time, i.e. services in his case, to selling products that are a lot more scalable. We also go into how to tell better stories, concepts like leverage, compounding, and other ideas that change his worldview, and Naval's epic tweet storm on building wealth, which kicked off his whole journey. Now let's get into the show. Jack, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you for having me on, mate. I appreciate it.
So listen, man, I've been following your work for some time now, and you've really stood out on social media with your social profile, Visualize Value. So we're going to be talking all about how you've grown that and how you've moved from services where you had an agency and moving to selling products where you're not selling just your time. But yeah, before we get into that, man, I'd love to just get your background. What are you doing in your own words?
A little bit of context. I grew up in the UK, studied graphic design for 3 years in 2007, graduated in 2010, and came straight out of that degree into a few internships in London. So I was doing a little bit of real world experience at the very beginning of my career. After 3 months or so in that, had a couple friends. This is a really long story I won't go into, but they were going out to New York just to, you know, go out to New York and mess about for a few months. And I had never done the traveling thing that a lot of my friends had done. So I was like, all right, yeah, I'll jump on that. And I came out to New York, and I don't know how familiar you are with Craigslist, but I went onto Craigslist and I just blasted a bunch of design.
I think I've heard of it.
Yeah, a bunch of design internship positions just to really meet people in the design industry in New York, and was fortunate enough to get one response. And the guy that responded to me was running a little boutique agency in West Chelsea in Manhattan. And we got together and figured out a way to make it happen. And then I guess the rest is history. I've been hopping around agency jobs in New York for close to 8-9 years after that first one, probably 8 or 9 jobs. And then in 2017, decided that, well, I came to the conclusion that I could build an agency of my own after all of that exposure, which was somewhat arrogant and naive at the time because I did it all by myself. And then worked in that, you know, worked building that for probably, well, it still technically exists, but was really heavy on the client work for a year or so in the beginning. Got incredibly burnt out and just, you know, didn't have the desire to grow the 20-30 person team with the office in the city, and all of those things were just not appealing. So just slowly kind of iterated on the agency model until I ended up in this place where now Visualize Value is really the main focus, which is a much more focused application of all the things that I've learned across, you know, those different design jobs and working in different industries and things of that nature. So I can get into explaining exactly what visualized value is, but I think some of your questions will probably give it a little more context as well.
No, that's a great background, first of all. And I think a lot of people who follow your stuff, you've got over 100,000 followers, I think, on Instagram and probably getting around there on Twitter as well. And that's only been done, I think, in like 18 months or maybe a little bit longer.
Yeah, January 2019.
Okay, so it's coming up to 2 years. But what's pretty amazing is, like, I know you've shared these numbers transparently, so I hope you don't mind me starting with some numbers, is you guys have got to $100,000 a month. It might even be more than that now. In revenue with 99% profit margins, which is kind of crazy for any traditional business, of course.
Sure.
So, and you've been able to do that through this process. And I know it started with you looking at this Naval tweet. And if people listening don't know who Naval is, he's like the founder of AngelList, but kind of like Silicon Valley's philosopher. So a lot of people love him. A lot of people find him annoying. I think he's great. I think he's got a lot of great value. But he has this epic tweet storm where if you go to Naval's Twitter, he's still got it pinned. I was looking at it last night again. And it's pretty amazing. It's basically how to get rich without being lucky or something along those lines. But yeah, it sounded like you were going through that and pondering it, and you kind of were like, something clicked for you. So I'd love for you to just kind of like take me back to that moment.
Yeah, so this is like, I think I stumbled upon that maybe a year after the agency work I was doing. So I think I'd gotten to a point in my career where I'd seen enough of the economics of an agency to be like, hang on a minute. Like, this is like, they're charging this much for this thing and I'm getting paid this percentage of it. And I'm doing what I consider to be a bunch of work, like in that final deliverable. And, you know, like I said before, there was an arrogant component to that, where it was like, there was infrastructure, there was stuff that surrounded me that made that stuff happen. But I think as a, you know, 20 something year old, you're like, yeah, I can do all that stuff. And so I'd gone down that route and got clients and won work, and then just essentially just got stuck in this really incredibly difficult loop where my time became the restrictive variable in that thing. So just trying to work harder and get your way out of these like really intense client relationships wasn't working. So the first iteration based on that insight was like, okay, we need to narrow the type of work we're doing. So originally it was like, we'll do video work, we'll make a website, we'll build an application, we'll, you know, do like physical printed pieces for an event, we'd do anything that you can like throw at a creative agency, we would have taken it. So the first kind of realization was like, okay, this is way too broad of a service mix. Like, if any kind of sanity is going to return to this thing, we have to narrow down or hire more people. And hiring more people is always, you know, you sacrifice efficiency and margin and all of that stuff. So if you really love doing it, I'm not like advocating against that by any means. That's just like not what I wanted to do. So the direction then was to just really narrow down the service mix. And one of the things that I sort of put together in hindsight, I think, is this process of visualizing these intangible ideas. So all work you sell as a creative agency would be pitch decks. And here's, you know, the visual articulation of why we think this is a good idea. Here's what the market looks like. Here's how customers behave. Here's why you're different from your competitors. And you have to kind of build this visual story around this intangible thing. And I'd noticed just over time that I'd gotten reasonably good at that because nobody else wants to do it. And it's the thing that closed a lot of business, right? So it's like the person working on the keynote is the first one in the morning, the last one out at night. And then you win the business, and then you kind of, in the agency environments I worked in, at least, it's like, you know, people get thrown into the like the front end or the actual above the line production of the work. And I kind of stayed behind the scenes and just do all the like pitch work and articulating the sales component of that like client engagement. So I was like, oh, maybe I could just start doing that, right? Just pitch decks. We don't do video anymore. We don't make websites. We don't do, we don't design applications. We just help you articulate your story visually.
again, to kind of stick with the theme of transparency, if you're okay with sharing, like what sort of revenue level were you at the peak of that service business compared to what you've got to now, if you're able to share?
Yeah, so I think a good month would be maybe 30, 40 grand, but that's like 50, 60 hours a week of labor. So it would be, it's definitely a decent living, but it's also incredibly like mentally laborious work too, especially when you're working with more than one client at a time, because you're trying to internalize all this complexity in like multiple industries at a time and spit back out these very simple representations of them. So it was a good living, but again, and we haven't completely eliminated that at this point. There's still a few like client engagements with like great businesses and great people that are still a ton of fun to work on. But obviously, that line of work is completely limited by how many people have that skill and can just apply it every single day.
Completely. And so we'll zoom back into Naval's tweet storm for a minute, and I'll just call out one of the, you know, we can't go for every single one here, but it kind of starts off with saying, seek wealth, not money or status. Wealth is having assets that earn while you sleep. Money is how we transfer time and wealth. Status is your place in the social hierarchy. Right. And when that seems like kind of like straightforward, but when you read it back 5-6 times, you realize like each part of that sentence is like, that feels like hours of thought put into a tweet, you know? And where it kind of comes back to your story there is, wealth is having assets that earn while you sleep, right? So to a certain extent, having an agency service business with employees, that is still technically the case. They're still paying you money per month. You've got other employees that maybe cost one third of the retainer that you might charge, whatever it might be. Let's go into that a little bit in a bit more detail. So how did you, you've had this insight and you say, okay, I need to move beyond selling my time. Like what happens from there? How do you actually think about what becomes visualized value?
Yeah, so a few different strands, I think, to this answer. The first is Naval, I think, his exposure to businesses that have that quality, they're probably really software heavy for the most part, right? Like custom software, built AngelList, an amazing platform that's all custom code and, changing a behavior in society. I was like, I don't really have that skill set. Nor do I have a network of people that have that skill set. So I was in New York. So my entire professional network is advertising, like no real tech, like no deep technology talent in my network at that point. So the concept that's being articulated there is like, you need to like produce an asset that, has zero cost of replication. That's another like piece of that thing that really got stuck in my head. And I'd started to apply that in the service business. So I think that kind of clicked a little bit. It's like the onboarding process was getting more sort of templatized, right? You take people through the same process. If you're trying to extract a story and re-articulate it, there are things that need to happen in every single engagement to make that thing happen smoothly. So you're getting like an introduction to this idea of like putting efficient processes in place and not reinventing the wheel every time you start a new relationship. So that's like the preschool version, I think. And like the elementary school version, which I think is what I'm doing now, is like, how do you take that entire process and articulate it in a way that, you can take somebody through that same journey, but it doesn't require your presence. So it really forces you to externalize, the way you think and the structure of the process and the actual skill set that I developed to make ideas visual was where I started with that. It's like, how do you think about that? What tools do you use to do that? What do you look for in an idea that makes it a candidate for even being visualized? So until that point in time, you don't really know how you think about it until you force yourself to articulate it. So that kind of took life as a curriculum. So build a curriculum that can enroll people in and they can go through it asynchronously and have the, everybody has the same experience, but regardless of, whether they're in Malaysia or New York or Surrey, like it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Love that reference. Also, I should pull this up since we're both from the British Isles. We got this.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
See it on the camera. Yeah, it was a gift from my friend Sergio. I'm not even that big a fan, but like, yeah, I'm all for the royal family. It's all good. So anyway, I have to represent, man. So, but yeah, and going really quickly, just on the Naval tweet, there was one part of that is exactly what you talked about there, which was fortunes require leverage. Business leverage comes from capital, people, and products with no marginal cost of replication, in brackets, code and media. Right, so that's where I think what I do love about that is not just code, because I think a lot of Silicon Valley can become a little bit like it's all about code, which of course there's other types of businesses, and that second part, media, which is kind of what you're talking about. When someone thinks of media, they think of potentially this dying industry or declining industry of newspapers and magazines that are going out of business a lot of the time. How did you then think about, you know, you talked about basically building a curriculum to teach people that might be your current clients or future clients that you can't service. How did you then think about that becoming a Twitter and Instagram handle where you're publishing these images essentially?
Yeah. So the original, the original intent of Visualize Value as a brand was as a lead magnet for service clients.
Got it.
So it's like, how can I demonstrate that I have this skill to the market and get inbound interest for, you know, the custom version of this? So started that with like, oh, let's share this case study of, you know, this really complex 3PL business that, you know, has all of this IP that they use to get a package from New Zealand to California. But most people don't care about that, right? If you're not in the shipping industry, you don't really, there's not going to grab your attention. So the impetus for it is really like, how can I demonstrate this skill in a way that's going to, how can I use ideas that are going to resonate with everyone to, you know, to draw attention to the fact that this thing works to better communicate complex ideas. And then, you know, that filled the funnel with more people that I could ever work with on a one-on-one basis. And then that whole process of seeing how much, seeing how much attention that drew is like, okay, there's something bigger here beyond, you know, what I can do one-on-one or, you know, how much time I could spend with people on a weekly basis. This is like, it almost became a brand, right? You think about it as a vehicle that can do a lot more than just, you know, bring people, like get people to book a phone call with you and work with you one-on-one. So it was that interest that really informed the, you know, the different iterations over time.
And that was always Visualize Value though, right? The same, this wasn't the name of your, because that wasn't the name of your agency at the time.
No.
So you separated and you created this thing. You said, okay, I'm going to show how people, you know, visualize value in these different industries. And it just started resonating with people. I'd love to go into that moment a little bit deeper as well, because we were talking about this just before we jumped on the call, before we started recording. So a lot of the focus of the conversation today is about building an audience from scratch, right? So you went into this with one goal and ended up transforming. But a lot of people I know who I speak to kind of stop at the first hurdle. And this isn't just to say like, oh, keep going, like some motivational story. I'm saying like physically, like I'll speak for myself. When I've started the podcast, I've been recording for 5 years. When I put it out first, like there's like zero people listening, of course, because who's listening to it? And even now, like I'll post something sometimes and it'll get like almost no views, and then I'll post something else and I'll get like tens of thousands of views. And it's sometimes there's no method to madness. But if I'm being honest with myself, that is tough mentally, because you want to spread the word. You want your guests, like I want to share this with you and you to be excited to want to share it.
Sure.
And when you see, oh, I've got like 27 views, it kind of discourages you from posting again. So how did you, like, did you have that originally, and how did you kind of overcome that?
Yeah, well, I think, and this is, I'm articulating this for the first time, because as you, the way you asked that question makes me think about it a little differently. I think the advantage I had in the beginning was I was only trying to convince as many people as I could work with, right? I only needed 3 people to be like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's
like,
cool.
I'll work with this guy. So like, I wasn't trying to grow an audience of 100,000 people, because that wasn't tied to, like, I wouldn't know what to do with an audience of 100,000 people. At that point in time, I was like, I need to just make this attractive enough that I can get a few people to sign on as service clients. And that, like, you know, it's almost the, like, if you don't chase directly after the thing, you have all these like byproducts, all of this, like, you know, the things you don't necessarily predict happening just based on the fact you're so focused on convincing one person that you can help them, that you just end up reaching people that are in the same position as a, just a ripple effect of that. And I think if you're kind of aiming at the goal of like growing a massive audience to begin with, it almost distorts your thinking away from the individual. And if you're not like focused on like perfecting a message for the individual, then, you know, it's like, I think it's a Seth Godin quote, like, everyone is not your customer. And there's, people have said it 100 different ways, but if you're talking to everyone, you're talking to no one. So that really was, I think, the way I thought about it is, even if I started this on my personal Facebook page, so it's like, there's like hundreds of people I'm connected to from school that are just like, what the hell is this stuff? This
know guy the is, feeling, man. Yeah.
It's posting. What is this? Yeah, right. Yeah. But it was enough to get me one retainer client. And that's the 3PL story I was saying. So there's a guy that is in New Zealand. I'm on Facebook. It's like, somehow, you know, he's seen this thing. He's like, wow, that's cool. Like, that takes an idea that's really complex and makes it simple. We have these conversations every day where people just don't understand what we're talking about. So do you think you might be able to help us articulate our story? I was like, yeah, let's do it. So that, I think, is that's the kind of paradox in that situation, is like, if audience growth is the goal and there's no, like, it's not feeding an objective, then you're not really like approaching it in a way that is like, you know, building something that is going to resonate with a very specific type of person.
Yeah, no, that's actually brilliant. I think I'll try to kind of relay what I heard, and you can tell me if I heard it correctly or if you meant something else. But just, and this is something I've seen across different examples, but when you hone in on a particular type of person, and we'll get to that in a second, what that means, that doesn't necessarily mean just demographic. It means like a mindset most of the time. It's like psychographic. Then the great thing with the internet is there's millions of those people all around the world. It's just being in an arena where they can be there discussing with you. So that kind of brings us onto the different types of platforms. So Facebook maybe isn't the best platform for that reason. And I think you, looks like you've kind of moved away from Facebook anyway. And your two main platforms right now are Twitter and Instagram. So maybe we could just take each one and discuss like why Twitter and why Instagram.
Sure. So Twitter, I can't even remember how I stumbled into Twitter, but this was like past the point of getting to that like really refined service mix. Mm. So I was soliciting clients on Facebook from this like network of people that I'd either grown up with, or like I'd gone to a couple of different entrepreneur events and stuff. Mm. And I got this like tiny network of people that were kind of internet marketers and stuff like that. And I think, like, I've had a Twitter account since 2009 or whenever it came out, whatever, but I just, you know, I go back and look at those tweets. It's like, just went to Burger King or something, you know, just like, did not use it as a tool for anything but nonsense at that point. And then I think around the time that I stumbled upon the Naval tweet storm, was like, wow, this is like a really crazy platform in a different way than something like a Facebook, because it's an open network. And there's downside to that. Obviously, people can attack you from anywhere in the world. Like, Facebook's has got a little bit more of a bubble around it, and it's a little bit more comfortable. And, you know, your friends are friends. You can restrict stuff. And I know you can do that on Twitter as well. But the upside that exists in that open network is so insane on Twitter. And I think the thing that really convinced me of the value was like, wow, I can tag somebody in something and they're going to see it. Right? Like, these people that are, you know, managing hundreds of millions of dollars of assets, or, you know, running a company of X amount of scale, it's like they're actually on their phone looking at something I wrote. That's absolutely
nuts.
It's
crazy. Right? Yeah. If you told our grandparents or even parents like 30 years ago that this could happen, like, you pull this thing out of your pocket and you could ping any person. Of course, there's a lot of noise and you need to stand out. But like, even last night when me and you were tweeting back to each other, like Naval was in that tweet and Naval liked the tweet, and that goes out to a lot of his followers will see that. So there is a network effect or whatever and discoverability on Twitter that isn't really there on Facebook. There might have been that some time ago, but even then it was within your own kind of networks and it spread very much like one to many, but in a closed group. So we'll definitely come back to Twitter, but that was awesome. That really makes sense on Twitter. What about Instagram? Because I know a lot of your work is visual, so of course Instagram makes a lot of sense. But what people think of Instagram today is very different to what it was, you know, even a couple of years ago. So I'm curious, like, how do you find Instagram versus Twitter in terms of that discoverability component? Because it's not that easy on there in the same way as it is on Twitter.
You know, again, in hindsight, all of these comments are made in hindsight. It's the Twitter focus to begin with was like just focus 100% on Twitter. Like, you know, the one thing I didn't mention in the last answer is that idea of being able to get in touch with anybody was really a layer on top of the way I was approaching visualized value. So before on Facebook, I was taking ideas from books and you could tag whoever on Facebook. There's no way they're going to see it, right? It's probably some team managing their Facebook page or something. It's essentially irrelevant. But this idea of, hang on a minute, I can read somebody's book, take an idea out of it, visualize it, tag them, and then they're going to see it. You know, maybe they'll like it, maybe they'll retweet it, maybe they won't. It doesn't matter. But you know, you do that long enough, and I did it for a long time. You know, a couple of retweets will get you a massive amount of attention. So built that audience up to, I forget exactly the number, but it was probably a few thousand before I started on Instagram.
You had something going on Twitter already. You could see it's resonating, and then you could take those learnings onto another channel and adapt.
Yeah, and honestly, just draft off the Twitter audience. So it's like, hey, we're on Instagram now. Bang, you already get like 500 people off a tweet because they like what you're doing on Twitter, so they move over to Instagram. And the cool thing about Instagram is it had bit of a different paradigm. So you have the slides, right? So you can do cool things with like revealing a message one word at a time, or you can break an idea up into two slides. You have this like mechanic where you can reveal things. So it's a little different. So it's like we're doing something slightly different on Instagram. It's like platform specific in the same way that, you know, you post different stuff on LinkedIn than you do Twitter. Like there's a little like change in the mechanic as you hop over to another platform. So the initial bump came from Twitter. And then I think you can experience virality on Instagram with the story share thing, you know?
Like, yeah, for sure.
People share to their stories and it's such a pattern interrupt, the black and white thing. Instagram's like oversaturated photo by the beach, you know, flesh everywhere. And then you just have this like black and white thing. You're like, wow, that's weird. That's what I attribute to, is it's just such a...
It stands like, out.
Break in the pattern.
Yeah. Actually, let's just actually explain that for someone who hasn't seen your stuff, because we didn't actually talk about the black and white. And we'll obviously, again, on YouTube, you can see this on the screen right now. But like this was all about constraints for yourself in terms of creating, right? And that's another thing we'll kind of go into a little deeper after. But like, why did you decide to have just black and white and the same text across the board?
Yeah, I think this is, again, something that you can look back at and be like, that's why it worked. But I think one is like all of the exposure to brand over the course of working in agencies for a long time, right? It's like there really is value in aesthetic repetition and hitting these like sensory signals over and over and over again. Like if you, so from a recognition standpoint, that makes a ton of sense, right? It's like someone instantly recognizes it and the name is just like seared in now. So an example of that would be when people now copy the aesthetic of it, someone will say, this is a visualized value thing, right? Yeah. It's like, because that was out in the market for months and months before. So it's just like that brand recognition is one part of it. And then another idea, which again is applied in hindsight, is you make one decision to save yourself a thousand decisions. Like as a designer, you have a blank canvas. You're like, what am I going to do here? Like there's 5,000 typefaces on my computer. There's, you know, 25 million colors on the color wheel. What am I going to do here? So that restraint of like black canvas, single typeface, geometric shape, it just creates so much constraint that it forces you to be creative in every instance. So it's like the barrier becomes like your ability to think rather than like these arbitrary style decisions. It's like it forces the ability to articulate the idea back onto you because you only have these tools to do it with, right? I also equate it to like if you walked into a workshop and there's like 20,000 tools, or you go to Home Depot, there's like 40,000 tools in the store there.
Yeah,
it's like, where do I begin versus like, here's a hammer and a nail, attach that thing to that.
Yeah.
Right.
Love that. And actually, I guess just to go one level deeper, the flip side to that is a brand becoming stale. Right. I actually had, I don't know if you know Red Antler, the design agency. So I had Emily Hayward on the show a few episodes back. And she obviously comes from a slightly different angle. But one of the concepts I thought, which was interesting, was kind of contrary to what you just said there. And again, anything creative is no right or wrong. There's,
sure,
you know, layers, of course, and a spectrum, sorry. And one of the things I thought she said, which was really interesting, was, in an age where you've got an Instagram and a Facebook and a billboard and packaging and 100 other things, you can use that context to adapt the brand. So it's not completely the same each time. And sometimes that means using an emoji or an icon instead of just the black and white or whatever. So again, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but what would be your opinion on the contrary side, which is to say like, well, you need to make sure it doesn't become stale. Like, how do you stop it from becoming stale when it looks the same each time?
Yeah, I mean, this feedback mechanism, I think it isn't becoming stale right now based on the numbers. So I don't have to change anything. I think there's like a, it's also like, as long as you have, I think the drive on the creative side too. I think there's two sides to that equation, right? Like brands innovate because they swap out their agency and like, new designer doesn't want to work on the same aesthetic that the old designer did as like some big pride thing there. I'm guilty of that as well. Like, let's throw out all of this equity that we have in the market because this new design team doesn't want to like inherit this stuff. I think both sides of the argument are interesting, but it's very like situationally dependent. There's a friend of mine named John Lombardo. He referred that, I think this is his quote. He said, good advertising wears in, not out.
Say that again.
Good advertising wears in, not out.
Okay. I love that.
Yeah. I think there's two schools of thought there. It's like, you know, keep your customer on their toes and like, is that them? Are they still doing that? Or it's like, oh, that's those guys, you know? And you always have a constant stream of attention coming in at the top of the funnel. The internet is so big, right? So like to think about the work you do in like a static way and like these are the only people that are ever going to see it is also a little bit of a like,
that's true,
odd way to think about it. So if it works, like that's, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's another way to think about that stuff. And that's a little bit of the approach.
One of the things you said there though was that there's the feedback mechanism. You're seeing it continue to grow, people are still commenting, etc. But if you start to see that change, then you might start to think, okay, there's obviously many variables that could be contributing to that, but maybe this is something I'm gonna switch up or try. And again, like you said, there's different ways to be creative outside of just the black and white and typeface.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's like also if your brand or your media entity, whatever it is, has a underlying objective, then the stylistic stuff can evolve alongside that objective, right? If your idea is to take something complex and simplify it, there's a lot of different devices, a lot of different ways you could go out and do that. And I'm not opposed to iterating on that and whatever tools become available that make that process more effective or increase the velocity of the ideas that we're putting out, I'm open to it. But it's, I think, you know, stylistic change for the sake of stylistic change, again, gets you in that loop of like, man, what do we change and why are people not resonating? If there's a reason for it, then I am all for it.
Makes sense. Yeah, I guess the classic example of this constraint is like the Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerberg, like clothing, and they wear the same thing every day. So, no, I definitely am in that boat. And I think you've clearly done a great job of it. So it's more just to understand like how you would think about it when you get to that point where you do think about changing things up. Just to go into that, a tangential point is around, you're now teaching this to other people, right? So one of the products, in quotes, if you want to call it that, is that makes up your 100K a month is a course. You have two different educational courses, basically. One on teaching people how to visualize value in the same way of the principles that you use to run your accounts and business and your obviously 10, 15 years of experience. And then the second one is moving from selling the service and time to selling products, essentially, and moving beyond that. So, but if we stick on that first part for a minute, like if I'm learning from you, which I have been, and I've been in your course recently, and it's, I definitely recommend it to people. How do I stop myself from becoming a version of you, like a worse version of you? Because you're obviously very talented. You've got all this background in creative and I don't. So if I just see your stuff and I'm like, okay, I'm going to do the same thing. And even if I'm not trying to, subconsciously, that might become the case. So how does someone like take those principles and really find their own voice?
Yeah, so I think it's a great question. I think a lot of people, like especially in the online education space, it's very easy to just start emulating the thing that you see. But I think the objective with this at a higher level is like visuals, like you kind of want to democratize the use of visuals, right? It's like everybody gets to use words to articulate their point and no one's like, oh, what if somebody else starts writing? Like then they're going to be a worse version of a writer than you are. Like I'm trying to get people to realize that you have like this, these tools at your disposal to better articulate your point, whether you're a doctor, rocket scientist, you know, you're a restaurateur, whatever it is. It's like, this is like a language that I think is appropriate for you to learn because you can get more people to understand what you do that way. And that's like, I mean, even me articulating that is like, there could be probably more context given to that in some of the courses. And a lot of people have reached that conclusion by themselves, but I think it's also easy to reach that other conclusion of like, let me build a, you know, let me build the same model that you built, which, you know, in most conditions is not, the result is not going to be the same because, you know, there's already this market that's been built and like the network effects have far exceeded that at this point. But yeah, I think about it, like if you were to compare it to a writing class, like how can you add this tool? How can you add this like, you know, string to your bow, as it were, like take a blog post that you've written and try and make an idea visual within it. It's not necessarily recommending that you make a carbon copy of the business model.
Yeah, that makes sense. No, for sure, man. And I think one of the things I learned in your work is the power of visual. And like, I think it was like 16 times, what is it? I've got it written down here.
15, I think.
15.6 yeah. times faster a human will process images versus text. And there's actually, and I'll try to take it from your course and put it on the screen here. There was like a visual where you compare text and then like just these images basically. And the images you get straight away, it was like, I think a pattern of like what's going to be the next image after this versus what's going to be the next block of text after this. And straight away the image, you're like, oh, of course, I get it. So definitely a really valuable skill. One thing you mentioned before that I want to come back to is the platform. And just to get a little bit more, I want to like just get in a bit more detail around that. So something you said was you working on one platform and then taking that audience with you somewhere else, right? And that might just seem like something kind of obvious to some people. But if you actually look at the world of people sharing how to build an audience, like I'll put that on one end of the spectrum and I'll put someone like Gary Vaynerchuk on another. Of course, for him, it's worked. He's got 10 million plus followers. And his approach, contrastingly, is be everywhere. 100 posts a day, go nuts on Instagram, Twitter, everywhere. And again, I think both can work and I think there's a balance to be had. But I think what people kind of don't realize when they see his approach work is that he now has 20 plus people working on his team. And in his defense, he did a lot of this before with zero team himself. But when he did it, the world was very different. Twitter was different. Organic reach was very different. Even Facebook back in the day was very different.
And just a byproduct of being like an early market entry, right? You're exactly. Everywhere by the function of you figuring this out before everybody else.
And I think that, and exactly. And I think what I'm starting to see is there's things you can take from his approach in his work ethic and his style of getting a lot more content out of one big long piece of content, which I love. But I think just hearing you say what you said, and Pomp, if you follow him, he's coming on the show in a few weeks. I've heard him discuss this as well, where he's got like 350,000 followers on Twitter, and then he built that up over a couple of years. He worked on that one area, and then he said, okay, now I'm going to build a podcast or a newsletter, and he did one at a time. Then he took that audience and went to YouTube, and now he's crushing on YouTube. And what I think I've probably done incorrectly in the past, one was not being completely consistent for 5 years, if I'm honest with myself. But secondly, was I was spreading myself too thin, both in terms of platforms and like actual time and workload, because I had a full-time job and a business. I was like, okay, I'm just going to put it everywhere. But you do need to focus, I think, in my opinion now, after seeing more examples. And that's why now you'll see I'm focused really on the podcast and YouTube as a extension to that, more for discoverability. But yeah, so I did want to just go into that point a little bit deeper, because I think a lot of the time you'll hear people give advice, but that was actually a lesson that people can hopefully learn from.
Yeah, I think it's all like instinct as well. It's like trying to hone your instinct in like 7 different environments at the same time is very difficult to do, right? If you like physically, that would be really hard to do. But like, I think maybe there's a blurred line because you think this is all on the internet, or, you know, you bucket it some way like that. But like the little cultural differences cross-platform are pretty huge, right? I can kind of predict now like how a certain idea will resonate on Twitter versus an Instagram, just by like having hundreds of thousands of inputs and feedback. Like, this is going to work a certain way there. Like, if I write, if I write in a certain style on Twitter, I think this is going to perform better because, you know, it's very hard to articulate some of this stuff, but honing your instinct, like one platform at a time. Pomp is a phenomenal example of this. It's like, absolutely killed it on Twitter for years. And why would you need, like, it's, you know, there's a we'll talk about the Naval book again, but the idea of diversification is for people that don't know what they're doing, right? It's just like you're essentially like shooting a shotgun. Like, maybe it's going to work over here, maybe it's going to work over there. Like, there are very few examples of like that kind of strategy working anywhere else in life. So this is no exception. I think like the results you can generate focusing on a single platform in the short term, I think far outweigh your ability to contribute like meaningfully across 7-8 platforms.
No, definitely, man. I'm glad we kind of went into that in a bit more detail. Again, but kind of building on that topic is this idea of platform risk. And if we think about Twitter and Instagram and any social media channel, I put that in the bucket of like rented channels. And then we've got something else, which is owned, which is nowadays, is, you know, you could argue what's actually owned, but like email is close to that. Your own website is close to that. But obviously getting people to the website is difficult. Yeah, I'd say podcast is close, even though you're kind of dependent on, you know, Apple could change the algorithm at some point. But generally, if someone's subscribed to your podcast, they get it delivered to their phone most of the time. So, yeah, I'm curious how you thought about that, because right now it's working for you. You've got up to 100K in revenue and hopefully beyond. And it sounds like most of your awareness and leads are coming through that funnel from Twitter and Instagram. So how do you think about that in terms of if the algorithm changes, organic reach decreases, like how are you going to get around that in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I don't give much thought to it, to be completely candid. Yeah. I think the rules will likely favor content that can draw attention. So I think some of the algorithm arguments are like a little strange, because like any platform is going to, you know, with the exception to like politically uncertain content, right? Let's just call it that. With exception to that, any content that draws eyeballs, the platform's going to push it as hard as they possibly can, because that's, you know, that runs in parallel to their business model, which is, you know, sell access to attention. So I think you're going to be rewarded for that on whatever platform you're on. Again, with that huge disclaimer of things that, you know, may not be, you know, I don't want to even get into that conversation. We've only got two
yeah,
hours.
No, yeah, but, I had to get you.
But I think the strategy is to keep making content that people want to look at, and hopefully that aligns with the objectives of the platforms that you're renting from. Have like a 10,000 person email list, which is, you know, small potatoes compared to like the social reach. And honestly, just as a platform is less, like for me, is less enticing as a creator. It just doesn't have the same feedback loops that the social platforms have. So yes, yeah, it's a really interesting conversation. I think the risk is low from what I've experienced to date, but who knows? I think, you know, you would continue to adapt, and I'm building an owned platform website, but it's really like, that's a different game you're playing. Like, you're competing for a much harder to win type of attention if you're like trying to move people away from these platforms where they're
already spending that time, for sure.
Yeah. So, and I think, you know, there's validity to that argument for sure, but there's also like, unless you're like incredibly good, like imagine what it would take to get somebody to set your website as their homepage. It's that's a completely different paradigm than we've experienced before. Like, if someone can go to a single location and have all of their stuff aggregated, you have to be like 10x better to get them off that platform.
Yeah.
And that's definitely a great goal to have over the long term, but you also have this incredible feedback loop on those rented platforms where you can evaluate what people want to see.
No, I get you. No, and I think that's a great answer, because I think one thing you just mentioned there really resonated with me, which is, as the creator, what do I want to do, first of all? Like, forget the optimizing for the end goal. And I think I even tweeted this last night with you, which was like, I count myself as a creator too. Like, I'm a business person, entrepreneurial person, but I've done like performance stuff and like open mics. Like, I'm a person who loves to create and I love the process of it. And that's generally who I resonate with most. And I think just thinking about, okay, why am I doing this, right? Like, it's not just to make money. Of course you want to do that, but like, I want to enjoy this every day. And if that means like I spend a few more hours doing it, but it means I do it for the platform I want to be, you know, that suits my strengths, then that makes a lot of sense. And I just want to add one other thing, which is, I think you already kind of are building this, you know, owned asset anyway. Like, the email to me is pretty close. Like, even 10,000, I mean, 10,000 is a lot, like, for obviously not compared to 100,000, but like, that's 10,000 people who have opted into seeing every single email from you.
Right.
And you've also built a community on your site as well. So I feel like you probably are doing it without like necessarily naming it that, the way I did.
Yeah. Yeah. What's interesting is, because so much of the business has grown through these rented channels.
Yeah.
That plays a big part in like the types of people in the community. Like, they all spend a lot of time on those rented channels. Therefore, it is a part of the ecosystem. If you take that stuff out and I'm just like writing emails to people every day, you're not in that set. It's not the same culture that you built it around in the first place. So like, I get the platform risk conversation, but again, like, unless you're like dipping your toes in some like hot water politically, then the risk to me, I may be way off here, does not seem like something that should keep you up at night.
Let's go into your creative process, because we kind of touched on it a little bit before, but I love this from one of your tweets. You shared the marketing strategy for visualized value. Number one, build things people will talk about every day. Number two, talk about them every day. And that's brilliantly simple. And I don't want you to have to like make up a whole marketing strategy beyond that, because I don't think there is. But like, I'm curious, like, if you were to expand on that and actually say, like, is there any more to it than just creating every day?
Right. Oh, I think I get asked this question quite frequently. The idea that in order to make things that resonate with people, you have to be able to test them against an actual experience that you've had. An idea that you can filter through more experiences, like, gets you to more of a like resonant truth, right? So it's like, if I've worked in this environment, that environment, met these kinds of people, lived in this place, that place, and this is a thought that I have, does that kind of marry up to all of these experiences I've had? If the answer is yes, then it goes out. So I think it's like the things that are like rattling around inside your brain all the time, those to me, like this is another weird like instinctual thing, is like the stuff that just like flies out of you tends to resonate more than the like really strategic, you know, let's try and break down this thing in like a ridiculous amount of detail. At least in my experience, it's been like the more organic it kind of flows out of you, the better it resonates. So that's where that like really concise version of it comes out of. It's like, you know, the things that are occurring to you in real time as you try to build this thing, those are the best outputs, and those attract the most attention. I think it was this morning, the same idea I wrote about, is like you essentially turn yourself into your own case study, right? If you're building products that you're education products in particular, where it's like if you can prove something and build a product that teaches the thing that you can prove, your very existence on this platform becomes a case study for the product you're selling. So it's just like this feedback loop where you just show up every day and it's like, this is working. I'm going to record this lesson into the product and then, you know, bring more traffic in on the front end. So it's this interesting, like self-fulfilling loop.
What, but I think something you mentioned there, which was like the stuff that comes out of you organically. And I completely get you on that. I feel the same, like the stuff that like I'll just tweet out or share on my Instagram, where, you know, like I do these interviews and we cut, just for context, like we'll cut this 1-2 hour interview into 4 or 5 clips for Instagram, Twitter, IGTV, email, etc. And that takes so much time, but like one random tweet about preparing for this interview, people will be like, oh, that's cool. And it kind of comes back to this principle of like showing your work, working in public. I've heard people describe it as, and because that's the real human stuff that people are going through that themselves too. They're like, oh, that's cool to see behind the scenes.
Right.
And so, but I think one, if we were trying to put some structure behind it, because I know it might not be like you've got this checklist where you're like, hey, I'm going to turn up in the morning and I'm going to write these fire tweets, right? Like there's a bit more of some serendipity to it. But I think there are probably some parts to it. So for example, when you capture ideas, are you like literally just like writing them in a notes app? Are you writing on a notebook? Like I'm curious like how you capture those ideas that then become something later down the road.
Yeah, I think there's definitely like tiers there. So I think some stuff goes into the notes and gets further developed, and other stuff is just like epiphany arrives as a result of doing a lot of mental labor. So it's like almost this idea of getting comfortable with the fact that you're working even when you're not working. You know, you're like constructing a sentence in your head for 25 minutes. And you feel like you're sitting there doing nothing, but then this like little polished version of the thought comes out. Like I write in notes on occasion. I think there's also this really like serendipitous process when you're trying to externalize the things that you've learned into a curriculum that really feeds a lot of like content that you can put out on the front end. So if I'm trying to explain, for example, why like Twitter as an open network is a really great marketing vehicle, if I'm gonna write 2 pages on that for a lesson in a curriculum, there's gonna be like 5 or 6 little ideas in there that will work really well on the front end. So it's like I think part just those like thoughts that just pop in your head as a result of not doing anything. That's I think a really important thing, is like get out of the, like I struggle with this too, is like get out of the constant input mode and allow the, you know, allow the connections to form subconsciously and something comes out of it. But also like the output of deep work, like I've gotten into this loop now where it's like I can't carry on writing this until I've like externalized that.
When you say you can't write this before you externalize it, what does that mean?
So I can't keep like the example, let's say like there's this concept reverse influence that we're talking about, where like I'm going to visualize Naval's ideas on Twitter and then I'm going to tag him in it, and then eventually, you know, he's going to amplify that to his followers, right? So if I'm trying to unpack how that idea works and write it all down, I'll get like halfway through and I'm like, oh, that's a good little thought. I'm going to put that out and see how people respond to that. And then I'm going to continue it.
Like
the
in
article.
Real time, you're saying.
Right.
Oh, got you. Okay. I didn't get that originally. Okay.
Yeah. So it's almost like that yeah, that instinct thing, or that, like, and I don't know whether this is the healthiest way to go about it, because it definitely keeps you on a platform.
It's like,
but it works.
Yeah,
it really is. And I've spoken to a few people about this. It's like those things that you just can't wait to, like, put out there. It's almost like when you're sitting in a room and, like, you're listening to a conversation and you're just waiting for a moment of, like, silence to add your thought. It's kind of like that same mechanism, even when the conversation is just happening in your own head.
What about, like, so you guys are actually publishing, like, one post a day, is it, right at the moment? Is that right?
Try to, yeah.
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 Sorry to get so tactical, but I would just love to understand, like, what that looks in practice. Like, are you writing a few of those in batches, like, or is it like today you're like, oh, I just had this great conversation with Bilal, I'm going to create something. Is it just you working on it? Do you have a team that you've outsourced some parts of it to? I'm curious how that looks as well.
Yeah, sure. So all the creative work and writing is me. So there's none of that is outsourced. My wife works with me on, like, all of the consulting side of stuff and all the community stuff and product stuff. So management and invoicing and all of that stuff. She's great at that. I'm terrible at that stuff. So that's great. And then we have Brandon, who's an intern, who's like, he's got building a Twitter audience, and he does a lot of work with some of the product inquiry stuff. So if people want to know whether course X is good for them, he'll get on the phone with them and chat to them for 15 minutes and walk them through that. And then we're building, like, a bit of infrastructure on the back end. Like, it's pretty rudimentary stuff right now. It's like there's no complex CRM or marketing funnel or anything like that. It's really just Twitter, Shopify, Instagram, you know, traffic flying around. There's a lot of, like, probably water leaking out of the bucket. If you were a, like, full-on e-commerce, like, wizard, you would look at this business and be like, you guys are, like, leaving so much money on the table because you're not doing your retargeting and your follow-ups and all of this kind of stuff. And that's just, like, not instinctual to me, not my world, but we're trying to kind of catch up on that end as well.
That's great to hear. I mean, I think that's amazing, because it means, like, you've got this raw thing that's clearly working and people are loving it, and then there's all these other things which to you might be more boring or, like, not instinctively happy to work on, that someone else who's really good at that can come in and they'll probably eke out another 30% revenue, if not more.
Right.
And that's a great position to be in, versus, like, oh, we have something that people don't like yet, you know, because, like, in a traditional, like, tech mindset, you found product market fit, right? Like, people are finding value of what you put out. I'd love to go into, like, your thoughts on, like, content and kind of storytelling more specifically, because I've heard you talk about this before. And I'd love to go in a little bit more detail, because I think ultimately what you're doing is you're telling a story in a tiny tweet, in a tiny visual form. And I've heard you discuss, like, different elements of a story and how you kind of, like, try to put that into a tweet. And a lot of the time you might think, well, how are you putting a whole story in a tweet, right? Because sometimes a story isn't a story, it's like an anecdote, which is fine. But and I'll just give a couple of thoughts that is to get you going. But a few of the things you mentioned were, like, a transformation of some kind, what it looks like before and after, like a contrast in a story, which I see a lot of in your visual work. And then start, middle, and end. A lot of the time you have that. Sometimes it might be shortened to a start and an end. But yeah, I'm just curious, like, is that something you're actually thinking about? Or is that just something you've internalized after, like, doing this for so long?
Yeah, I definitely think the visual component of the process has honed that skill. It's like, if you can look at something, like, if you can read something and then try and just refine it or just take out all the superfluous information, normally it's, you know, I mean, any story is like, you know, there's a point where it begins, there's a point where it ends. So it's like there's some transformation happening from here to here. And I think a lot of the writing stuff without the visuals is like, this is a, maybe, like, incredibly esoteric way to say it, but it's like you're kind of making a statement that someone can put their own story into, right? You're trying to articulate something that is, like, conceptual to the point where wherever you are in your life, you can like layer that idea on top and be like, oh, that was like, you know, when, from when I was not publishing my podcast every day 5 years ago to now, that concept or that like principle still lays over the top of that. So I think like writing something that somebody can sort of put their own story into and it helps the concept better resonate is almost the, I think that's the subconscious process that's going on there.
No, man, I'm literally looking at a visual and I'll show this on the camera for you and on the screen will, sorry, can you see that? This one? Yeah, so this was, and I'll share it on the camera too, but we'll do an overlay for people watching. And this is like one of my favorite ones, like pieces of yours recently. Like I almost want to like get it printed on the wall or something because, and for people who are listening only, there's like an upward trajectory graph, but like 70% of the graph is like 0, 0, 0. And then there's a point where it says, this is pointless. And then there's this huge bump straight after that. Actually, Scott Harrison, founder of Charity War, who I used to work with, he just posted this a few days ago on his social, and that's where I saw it. And I was like, oh my God, that's like so perfect. And what you just mentioned there is exactly that. Like I saw that and I think of myself because inherently people do think about themselves and they want to see themselves in the story as well. So I really love that, man. That's actually not something I thought about until you said it.
I think it's the reason why a lot of these, like this format, I think is popular too, is like, what parallels can I draw between what person X is doing or has done and where I am? Because like, it's really not that complicated. And a lot of the principles are universal, right? It's like, you're just gathering all this evidence by, exposing yourself to so many people's different stories and drawing out some of the consistencies and trying to imply them yourself.
Yeah. And just one last thing I'll share on that is my old boss used to say, when you look at a photograph, who'd you look for like straight away? And you always look at yourself, obviously, because we're all vain. And that's the same. And we would use that in a less sexy environment where we're presenting a deck to someone, but we're saying like when you're presenting a deck, like where's the picture of that person? Like where are they on the screen there?
What's in it for me?
Completely. Yeah. And that's an easy principle to say out loud, but like harder to do in practice.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's a bit of a freeing idea, really, is like the notion of creating stuff that doesn't, that is more in line with the experience you had is going to help more people. So it feels like it's like an arrogant expression of what you're going through. But if you try and generalize it past the point of your own experience, it doesn't resonate with anyone because it's entirely made up. It's like you have the source material and you can just reiterate it in a way that people can sort of see it and apply it to themselves.
The last piece on this, because I think we've done quite a good deep dive into your process and how you've built this audience. And again, summary is there are no tricks, but you know, you've found something that is valuable. You've stuck to it and you've iterated and done one platform at a time. And I think that's definitely something people can try to replicate those principles. But the key thing for me there is really about consistency. I'm wondering from your point of view, you were clearly busy doing 60-hour weeks with your agency. Like, how did you manage to, what are certain things that helped you stay consistent?
I thought a lot about this, and I think one of the advantages of like having a career with a tangible skill that you can output is really, it becomes very obvious to you what you can sustain. And I don't think a lot of people start this from a perspective of what can be sustained, right? It's like they think about what is possible, not what I can do on a consistent basis. And that is where I think people get stuck. And if you have this like mega heavily produced YouTube video, let's say you go, I'm going to do a vlog every day, right? And then you shoot 8 hours of content. You got to scrub through that. You got to edit it, do your titles, do your jump cuts and all that stuff, right? You do one of them, you're like, man, this is a heavy, heavy load of work that I've got to do. And I'm not advocating against hard work. I'm just saying starting from a position of producing something that you can sustain is an incredibly like different way to look at that. It's like, it obviously has to get to the point where it resonates. But if you can just lock in the consistency component first, like one of the first things I did from consistency perspective is write an email every day. It's like, I'm not a great writer. Like I'm not great at writing consistently either. So I'm just going to commit to this thing for 60 days. And I think I had like, honestly, it was the Facebook day. So I maybe got 30, 50 people to sign up for this thing. I just wrote every day. It's like, yeah, I can carve out 20 minutes in an evening to write. And these are literally like 4-sentence emails.
Yeah.
So nothing crazy. And then when you kind of see the compound effect of that, I think a lot of people, you pick something that's too hard to sustain, so you never get exposed to the potential of the compound effect, right? It's like if you're only going to produce something 3 times, you feel as though you've poured 300 hours of energy into these 3 things and you lose belief in yourself, as opposed to that streak, even if it doesn't resonate with anyone, you end up proving to yourself that you're capable of producing something every day, which is a way like more valuable lesson than the results of the output even. So there's like a couple of different ways to think about it, I think, but that idea of like picking a format that you can sustain, and we talked about that a couple minutes ago, it's just the idea of go to the platforms where you can instinctually contribute, as opposed to our person who I admire is doing this format, so I'm going to try and completely emulate that thing. Like podcasts for me, I get asked every week, do you have a podcast? You're going to start a podcast. I'm like, I don't want to. Like, I couldn't really do this the same way that you do, like with that like page of notes. I'm just never going to do that.
Yeah, for sure, man. No, that's a great point. And that's a great point. I think for me as well, similarly, one of the reasons I like podcasts and long form conversation is because when I started doing this recording in 2015, it was like the complete opposite of the trend. The trend was make everything shorter, which of course has value, and we should try to make things as short where they can be. But what I was finding was like there's value on Twitter for those little anecdotes and quotes and small thoughts. But what I was missing was like the deep conversation where like if we went for dinner, we would be talking for 2-3 hours, right? And we would have a great conversation, but it's different to like having a question answer, like tell me this answer, which is why the style of this show is really about two of us just kicking it and talking about stuff, right? And we have some structure, obviously, because I'm not Joe Rogan, but like, you know, it's like that's kind of what I enjoy. I get energized by speaking to people like yourself and people that I meet through the show, and I like taking out some of those ideas so other people can learn from it the way I do. So yeah, completely, it's all about like what you care about and what you're suited to as well.
Yeah, I think you said it like the perfect word in there is energy. And it's like if something you do gives you energy regardless of who sees it, that is like the signal that you need to pay attention to, right? And this goes back to like the thing that we mentioned at the very start. It's like pursuing the thing directly, like starting a podcast to grow an audience of people is never going to work. Starting a podcast to have conversations with people that you're interested in getting to know and like understanding how their process works, what you're doing is going to get you the Gary V's and the, you know, the Seth Godin's of the world, because they see that like this process has been sustained as a result of you caring about it. It's the same reason why like Gary V's not going to be your first episode, right?
No, yeah, he wasn't, but
it's kind of proving to the market as well. That same "this is pointless" thing, I think like the Naval idea is a good one, where, you know, you have to see that I've done this 10 times over the course of 6 months before you're going to use your platform to amplify something that is just this like throwaway thing that somebody's doing. So I think it's like, even if it doesn't feel like the direct feedback is a thing, the other great example is the Joe Rogan first podcast, right? If you go back 10 years, like this car wreck of a video.
It's like the first 15 minutes are like they're trying to figure out how the webcam works, and now he's got like 50-60 million people listening. Or it's crazy.
I think there's obviously a lot of forces at play. Like the size of the internet is so overwhelming that there's, you know, the amount of competition definitely does increase, but there's also just this overwhelming amount of people that don't make it very far because they don't get this instant feedback. And to go back to like the very first conversation we had, there has to be something about it that benefits you beyond who you reach or the dopamine thing that you get as a result of putting it out in the world. It's like me working on these ideas, whether or anybody sees them, is going to make me a more competent graphic designer. So is that a skill worth doing? Yes. If I share it, does it lead to other opportunities? Yes. It has to have something like foundational that it benefits you personally. You know, the whole vain thing that we're coming back to. It's like, if you get that in there, then, you know, even if nobody sees it, you're still winning.
That's exactly perfectly put, man, because I feel the same with like anything I've done, not just this, just I am someone who like likes lots of ideas and I like to try different things. And because of that, I've had to like get better at basically writing out like what's in it for me. Like before I started this, I wrote out like, yeah, I want to build an audience and make money and I want to meet all these people. But really, like if I was stat ranking them, I wrote number one, I want to learn myself. And like I spent 3-4 years in business school and I worked in, you know, at Google and did all this stuff to learn about business. But I was like, I loved it. I could talk about this for 10 hours a day with friends, and I do. And if I got to do that and other people got to gain from it, that's sick. But yeah, if I just gain from it, then I've already won. And then if right, 7 people listen or 7 million people listen, then that's the upside. So
yeah, I mean, you'll struggle to find somebody that's like dominating anything that doesn't like get something out of it personally, right? There's the like, I can't remember the exact quote. I'm reading The Rational Optimist at the moment, Matt Ridley. And there's a, you know, the whole idea of trade and the movement of an economy is dependent upon the individual pursuing something that is gonna like improve their lifestyle. And there's no different whether you're doing that by selling bread in a shop, right? Or you're like making stuff and putting it out on the internet. So it's pretty fascinating. And it, you know, there's definitely, to your point, it's like it can feel demoralizing when you're comparing yourself to people that have been doing it for 10 years. But if you have in the back of your mind, I'm gaining from this regardless. Like, you know, I could go back 3 years and look at stuff on Facebook where only my mum is putting a like on it, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
That's feeling, not too man. Far. That's not too long ago. Yeah, hello, mum. And yeah, you just keep doing it because it's like, you know, I'm becoming a better graphic designer and my clients are getting better quality product because of this thing I'm doing. I just happen to be doing it in public.
So we're going to wrap up this part of the conversation, man. Thanks so much for sharing all about your process and building an audience from scratch. There's a lot of lessons in there. I'm just curious, like looking forward, you've been doing this for almost 2 years now. You've got to 100K in revenue. You're doing really well. What does the future of Visualized Value look like for you? And how does it ladder up into a master plan, or is it just like going along with what you're already doing?
I think there's the master plan has always been to try and help people come to some of the same realizations that I've come to over the past few years that have improved like the quality of my life, which I think is to some degree a predictable path, but also like, you know, if you'd have told me 3 years ago I'd be doing this, I'd be like, there's no chance. So I think trying to have the company and the media brand reflect the things that I, you know, learn to be useful on this journey feels to me like that's kind of the trajectory. So building it into more of a media company that can better organize and display some of these ideas is really like the next step of it. So I know we talked about platform risk and the idea that this thing exists purely on social. I think over the long term, I believe that there is a bigger audience for this than purely social, and more specifically people who are building businesses. So it tends to appeal to the entrepreneurs, the technology crowd, like people who spend 6 hours a day on Twitter. But I think there's a bigger, you know, there's much more value to be provided, if you'll excuse the pun, to like a wider audience.
Killing me, man. Yeah. All right. I love that, man. Well, look, man, I think I don't say this with hyperbole. I think you're definitely one of the most talented designers. I don't even want to just call you a designer, but like someone who's taking ideas and turning them into visual things like that I've seen. It's clearly resonating with lots of people. So I'm really excited to see where that goes. The last part of the conversation we'll just touch on is just more of a fun chat between us. We've got our royal family mugs ready. You've got yourself a drink too.
I don't think they're in the royal family anymore, are they?
They're not officially, but you know.
Excommunicated.
Yeah. The OG royal family. So yeah, I guess kind of to finish off, this kind of part of the show we sometimes do is really about our behind the mind, and we just discuss some interesting ideas. And considering we both really love the Naval tweets, I would love to like just go into some of these points and see if anything, like what you thought of it and why it really resonated with you. So we're not going to go through every single one, but I'll call out a couple. So the first one I mentioned earlier, which is seek wealth, not money or status. Wealth is having assets that earn while you sleep. Money is how we transfer time and wealth. Status is your place in the social hierarchy. The second one was understand that ethical wealth creation is possible. If you secretly despise wealth, it will elude you. And that, to me, when I heard that, I was like, man, I just want to like drop a microphone. Like, I want to put on a t-shirt. Like, I was like, that is bars, man. Like, that's what I wrote to Naval last night that he liked. So like, I'm curious, was like out of those two already, was there anything that really like hit you as well the way it did to me?
Yeah, I mean, I think every single one of those tweets in that sequence had a different epiphany. I think the seek wealth, not money or status, as it relates to what I was doing when I read that, was incredibly profound, because what I was doing at the time was trying to work with massive brands to make like a better living, essentially. So there's like, it's chasing the check and the name that you can put on the door of the agency to chase another check with another name. So you're kind of in this endless loop,
yeah,
as opposed to the wealth equation, where it's like, okay, let's think beyond just how much money I need. Let's talk about, you know, true wealth. And I think he talks about that in there, which is essentially how you spend your time, how much of your time you spend doing something you don't want to do is essentially like a better indicator of your lack of wealth than how much money you have.
Like actual freedom from, and that word is thrown around a lot and it's become political, especially in the States, but like, that to me is really what a lot of people are looking for. And like, before they get past that first level, 98% of the world is just thinks that they need to earn a lot more money and then they're going to be okay. And even if we know money doesn't make us happy, the translation to that of, if I was the boss, if I was five levels higher, if I had X, Y, Z. So I think that's definitely, that resonated with me as well. And then the next one, which was ignore people playing status games. Now, let's both keep it real here. We both worked and we've done agency stuff. We've worked, like, I have brands in my background that I definitely lean on because it opens doors. So that would be stupid not to do that. But I'll ask you an honest question. Do you feel there's a part of you that leans on those brands because it kind of gives you some value as well, like worth? Like, and if it's fine, if not, if the answer is no, I just wanted more clients. But I think that's often the case for a lot of people as well.
Yeah, I feel embarrassed about it, honestly. Like, I struggle with mentioning it. Like, I, at the beginning of my career, the beginning of my business ownership career, let's say, I was like fortunate enough to get a massive client. You would like maybe the most famous brand in the world as a client. And then when I was going to...
Was it Nike?
I can't tell you.
Oh, you can't say. Oh, damn. Okay, cool. No.
But essentially, like, that felt like an outrageous thing to say when you're going to pitch a $5 million a year, like, service business, or, you know, it was almost this, like, there was just this inconsistency there where it didn't resonate with me in a way that I thought it would after I got it, right? Like, other people are way more impressed by it than I was. And it's like, well, no, you know, it's not really that special. It's just kind of like a series of lucky breaks and I happen to know somebody here and blah, blah, blah. And you could just see that arbitrage opportunity and how much people are like blown away by it. And it kind of made me uncomfortable because I was just like, oh, no, it's not really about those guys. It's about the stuff that we do. So, yeah, I don't think that's ever been a huge driver of mine. But I can see why. Like, I mean, yeah, it has its massive advantages and it's definitely like propelled me at certain stages of the journey as well. It's just, I think, you know, you may empathize with this as a fellow Brit. It's like a little bit of a, you know, I don't want to go out there and like beat my chest too much. Yeah.
No, that's a big thing. And actually, we'll come to the US-UK thing in a second, but thanks for sharing that, first of all. Like, I'm curious, do you feel like that there was a form of imposter syndrome there at all for you? Like, where you felt like, how am I getting this? Like,
100%.
And you're just like, well, how am I getting this when I'm just like an individual person and there's like this real agency down the road who's like got 15 people pitching them at the moment?
Yeah, I think maybe my view of it has changed now, because I would always like put my work up against a team of 10, 15 people in most cases. Like, I worked really hard and stupidly so at the detriment of my health at the time. But I just didn't believe in like the services that industry provided overall. So it was just like, I could be proud of the fact that I've created this this arbitrage opportunity where I'm just doing the work of 10 people, but I don't really, like, I'm not that proud of like being involved in this entire like ecosystem. So it doesn't really serve me to like leverage that to get new opportunities, even though doing something entirely different, it still gives you that credential. It's like a university diploma. It's like, if you went here, no matter what you want to do, people will be like, oh, that person's legit.
Yeah. And it's a weird, thing, because we kind of are moving away from like traditional academia. I mean, we're definitely not moving away completely, but like there's a transition to like online stuff. Obviously now with the current situation, we're doing it all online. So there's just an acceleration of that. I don't think brands like Harvard and Oxford and Cambridge are necessarily going anywhere anytime soon. I think they actually have a really good opportunity to get more people to attend their universities, in air quotes. But I think it's more like the second and third tier ones, where if anyone can attend essentially like those sort of classes, like there's going to be some interesting developments there. But I think it comes back to like the brands. Like, ultimately Harvard, Cambridge, Oxford are brands, the same way Google was a brand for me, and in your world your brands were the same for you. So I think people do still kind of like get to that point really quickly where they say, okay, that person worked on the biggest brand in the world, therefore they know what they're doing. We can just assume that. And I think that probably comes from like the survival thing back in the day. Like, we don't have time to figure it out when there's a lion about to eat you. So you just have to trust your instinct there.
Yeah, there's a nobody gets fired for hiring IBM. You know that one?
yeah, classic. Yeah, that's true. So the other one I just wanted to lean into a little bit was, if you secretly despise wealth, it will elude you. And this one hit home for me, because I definitely don't feel like that right now. But I, again, keeping it real with myself, there was probably a period in my like last 5 years where I was like, you know, we're Europeans living in America, so we're probably already a little bit more left-leaning in terms of social stuff anyway. So I was like looking at this big industry that I'm in, making good money, and I was starting to get disgusted by like the inequalities of the world, which is true. Like, I still feel terrible that someone has to sleep on the street. But what I didn't realize I was doing was starting to despise that same thing. And to me, it wasn't like, the problem isn't someone creating a business like yourself, working hard and doing something great. The problem is that there aren't enough opportunities for other people, and there are some huge disparities between people. And I actually look at some of my really close friends, people I've grown up with, and we talk about this stuff all the time. And I'll see stuff like, you know, this recent trend where there was a post about billionaires should not exist. I don't know if you saw that on social media as well.
I see it all the time.
Yeah. And again, we could debate that for 2 hours, and we probably don't have time today. But to me, that comes from the same principle. There's another quote around this, which is, do you love the poor or do you hate the rich? And I can't remember who said that, but I heard that and I was like, oh, damn, that's a kind of hard hitting thing. It's like, do I really care about, you know, these people that I went to a nonprofit for 2 years, right? And I was trying to help the poorest people in the world. And I think that was genuine. But then I'm also like, well, do I actually just really hate the rich because I'm not them? Or am I like trying to punch up? You know what I mean? Where I think it's quite a hard balance to hit, because some people aren't happy with their own lives and they can kind of manifest it in this kind of anti, you know, billionaire thing is one thing. But just like, you know, essentially going against the current system and trying to throw the whole system into a new one. So I don't know. Yeah, that was just something I wanted to share as well, because I don't know if that resonated with you as well.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I think the whole notion of leverage as well is like a really insane concept that once you figure it out, even on a small scale, like I have, it's like, man, there are certain people that if you do not understand this concept, doesn't matter who is like, who you're paying taxes to, who you're, you know, who's sitting in the official building of the government, doesn't matter. If you don't understand this concept, like, you will not be able to generate resources in the same way that somebody that does. And you have to work like 1,000 times harder for a tenth of the proceeds, right? So I think I came from the same place before, where it's like, oh, it's crazy that somebody can do like so much less physical labor and be rewarded so much exponentially more than someone else. And I agree with all of the, like, you know, the fundamental issues that exist there is like education and all of those, like the inequality that exists on like helping people understand how the world works is really the fundamental problem, right? But I empathize with the position you took as well. It's like, man, I even when I was in a corporate job, it's like I'm getting paid to essentially just like do this like charade, right? It's like this, what does someone call it? I can't remember who said it. It may have been Naval as well. It's like play work, right? It's almost just like you're going in and like acting throughout the day and going to these meetings where nothing gets done and things. It's like, it's insane. Like this money's being deposited in my account and I'm contributing, sure. But what have I really seen happen over the course of my 8-year career in the businesses that I've worked with? It's very hard to like tie myself to like some exponential outcome. So going like moving out of that system and starting to like control all of your inputs and like have exposure to the downside completely changes your worldview. And that, like, I mean, that's a huge conversation that I may be like nowhere near qualified to explain in much detail, but that the worldview shift that happens when you go from being an employee to a business owner is like, is just outrageous. And it's like, you're almost talking a different language to people that haven't made that transition. And I think that's where a lot of this, like,
kind of hate comes
really
from.
Aggressive disagreement comes from is, yeah, the fact that, you know, people empathize with small business owners, but they also like expect a certain outcome in a job. Like this is something that I, like, when I had like a couple of my corporate jobs, I would complain about my work all the time. And then when I like owned my own business, I was like, man, I was such an entitled idiot.
Same, yeah, completely.
And like, no, it was unbelievable.
Yeah. No, I love this conversation, man, because I think I don't really get to talk about it that often. And for me, like, one of my core values, if you were to be official about it, is like equity and fairness. And I, of course, like, everyone cares about that. But if you spoke to, like, I've had like these coach people that I've worked with in my last job, and they were like, man, you don't realize how much you over index on this side. Like, I'm like really positive when someone treats me fairly, and I'm the complete opposite. If you mess around with me and I can see you're trying to get one over, like, I'm gonna go in, you know.
Right.
That, to me, even in my personal relationships and stuff like that, it's like, that's really important to me. So what I realized was, when I was in jobs where I was doing amazing work, I would win an award, and then I would get like a performance review, which was like average, I'd be like, what? This doesn't compute. And I'm like, you're, and the manager at the time would be like, look, Bilal, we know you're doing well, but you've been in this role for X amount of time, so you statistically can't be above this rating. And I'm like, okay, well, this is, that just takes all motivation away, right? So that is the moment where I'm like, okay, this employee stuff at the moment in this current form, it's just not going to work with me mentally. Like, I could work and do the job, but I'm not going to be happy because I don't feel that this is fair. Whereas contrastly, when you have your own business, everything is on you. Like, if you don't have that client paying you and you're not providing value to them, they're not paying you next month. So there's this kind of funny thing where there's actually a lot of equality, if you want to call it that, in owning your own company as well.
Skin in the game.
Completely.
Yeah, I think it's like there's a whole nother tangent of this where you talk about freedom. It's not really like anybody who thinks that starting a business is going to like grant you the freedom to do whatever you want is like, is, you're kidding yourself essentially, right? There's still people buying your product and you owe them a service. If they have a problem, you need to like get in touch with them. You need to pay people to help them. Like, you have a responsibility as a business owner.
And it never really turns off either.
Yeah, it's a different type of responsibility. It's just like, that is the trade-off that you then weigh up is like, and I worked in the agency business, so I would never turn off even when I was an employee, right? So I come home from work, I got my laptop open on the sofa and I go in mornings, weekends, all of that stuff. So I don't think I had the full contrast, but when I was growing up, you know, you work in like, I worked in Honda in Swindon in the factory for 6 months. That's hard work, man.
Well, like manual labor factory or what?
Putting cars together, yeah.
Oh, sick. Wait, is that where you grew up, by the way? Or
Swindon.
You grew up in Swindon, all right. Because I know you went to school in Wales, but so I wasn't sure if you had some Welsh in you too.
No. 70 miles west, right? Yeah, so like those kinds of jobs where you can, like there's a lot of merit to like clocking out, you punch the card and your brain empties. Like, I've got empathy for people who want to live that way because Completely. Some days I'm like, man, why am I going to sleep thinking about this? And you have to kind of train yourself out of that. And it's, you know, if I would say that I can completely shut it off, I'll be lying.
Yeah, man.
So there's trade-offs for everything. Like, nobody's, you just have to essentially make decisions based on, you know, what the most, kind of balancing that enjoyment with, the amount of like mental stress you can tolerate at any one time.
Yeah. Just to wrap up that last couple pieces there. You talked about UK there. This is actually a question that a couple people asked on Twitter when we posted this. So I'm curious, as someone who's lived in both the US and UK, and so have I, like, what was there any things that really surprised you when you moved, differences in culture, work-wise or otherwise?
How long have you been in the States?
7 years, 2013.
How old are you?
I'm 32.
I'm 32 as well. And I came here in 2011. So I'm a couple of years ahead of you.
Yeah.
So I had almost zero professional experience in the UK. Like, I did a 3-month internship. So I've never had a full-time corporate job in the UK. Like, so that, like, comparing the two design industries, I would have.
Yeah, context for like you, and you were much younger and it was a very different stage of life almost.
Yeah, like, I've grown up professionally in the States for sure. And I think that's had a huge impact on the way I think and the way I work. And, you know, when I contrast that to some of my friends that are still in the UK, they have a very, very different work relationship with their work than I do, right? And my network of friends in the States, most of them are entrepreneurs. In the UK, all of them are working for someone.
And like, are they mostly from school? Like, you know them from...
Yeah. All my friends are from school. It's like, you know, I didn't really build a network around my professional life in the UK. There's a couple of people I met in my first like little internship job. But yeah, the culture is like ridiculously different, I think. Like and industry... I mean, I can't speak to like the contrast between specific industries because I've never worked that way. But I've had like... friends that have worked in places that do business on both sides of the Atlantic, and it's always, you know, Americans taking it way more seriously than Brits for a lot of the time. And that's a gross generalization in the industries that my friends have worked in, but it's just it's a totally different
it's a different mindset, I think, work-wise.
I mean, you talked, the social structure is different, everything is different, right? What I find really bizarre is the social safety net in the UK is much more robust than it is in the States, but there are way more risk takers as a general rule in the States than there
are.
It's
funny, right?
And I think, it's, you know, I'm not a historian, but I think it has probably the maturity of the UK and the, you know, the culture that's been bedding in for hundreds and hundreds of years in contrast to the States, which is a really, you know, still a young project essentially.
Definitely.
It's just like it's flying off the rails. We all know everything's going nuts here all the time.
Yeah, that's a great I love that distinction, because it's not to say the UK is doing it wrong. Someone might say they're doing it better in a way, in terms of balance of life and well, I mean, UK is a very specific example with Brexit and everything too, but just Europe as a whole, I think the culture, like I worked in Google London, Google Dublin, where it's European headquarters. So I met people from all over EMEA essentially, and then New York and the rest of the US for the last few years. So I've seen like the difference in culture, and a couple of things really stood out to me. One was like the number of vacation days or holidays that you get, right? Like in most normal jobs, you get like 10 days in the US, if that, like 10, 15 max. And in the UK, like you're 21 years old, everyone gets 25 days, and that's 5 weeks and people take 2 weeks holidays, and it's like normal. It's like that's what you're supposed to do. So that's just like that already is like such a big difference. But then on the entrepreneurial side, I think there's some incredibly smart, amazing entrepreneurs there doing great stuff in Europe. But there is just this scale of the US that's quite hard to compete with. And there's this other thing that another guest of the show, Josh White, he sold 3 companies for $800 million. He's a Brit that lived in New York for 20 years or something like that. And he said the big difference he found was just, you could cold call someone in the US and cold call someone in the UK or send a cold email. And on average, you'll get more replies here. Like if you're saying the same message, you'll get someone responding with, okay, is this going to make me more money? Is it going to save me time? Cool, I'm more open to it. And again, this is a massive generalization, but that's been my experience as well.
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, another along those lines, I think in conversation, you meet someone in the US, it's like, what do you do for a living? Is the first thing they ask you.
Yeah.
Almost always. And maybe this has changed in the UK from when I was there, but that's like, people don't really like...
It's not the first thing necessarily.
It's not the first thing you talk about. You might talk about it, but it's like, I think work is like a way more, it's way more tied to your identity in the States. Yeah. In the same way that education is, because there's such a bigger system too, right? It's like people wearing their friggin', you know, university around and like sticking on their cars. And like in the UK, like very few people are doing that. So it's just a totally different animal.
Yeah, that's what I didn't think of that. Cause that's often like sports team related too. And of course, like college sports is a whole different thing, which you don't get the scale of until you're here and you're like, what, there's 100,000 people watching a game of college athletes. Like you don't even get 100,000 people at an Arsenal game. Like it's crazy. That's cool, man. Yeah, I think that's definitely interesting to share. And then we're going to wrap up soon because I know we both got to go in a second. But let's just tie it back to that last bit of Naval's tweet, since that's been kind of a common thread throughout the conversation. The last one is, when you're finally wealthy, you realize that it wasn't what you were seeking in the first place, but that's for another day. Like, first of all, what a sick way to finish. But
incredible.
But I guess the kind of open question is, if you're listening to this, Naval and Jack, like, what do you think he meant by that? And like, if you were answering that, what would you say it would be?
Well, I think, you know, I wouldn't call myself wealthy in a traditional sense, just numerically speaking.
Right? Yeah.
But well, I want, like, my observations have been, even with like increasing income, like it doesn't really change that much about how you think, right? If you have like a busted set of models in your head and you're worrying about a certain thing, like there's another great, I think this would be a Naval endorsed quote, like by Nassim Taleb, which is essentially the more resources you have, the more fragile you become, right? The more you have to lose. So you kind of get, you get more protective and you get more nervous about the decisions you make. And that's like a really weird situation to be in, because you assume that number X is going to make you feel comfortable. Like if you told me 3 years ago that I'd be in this situation, I'd be like, oh, I'll be driving a Ferrari and I'll be, you know, I'll be buying an 8-bedroom house. And so it's just like, that's just not how it works, man.
Yeah,
it's like,
you're not even also, thinking about it. Yeah.
Yeah, you're not thinking about it. And like, I don't think, I mean, at the scale that those guys are talking about, it's just out, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in net worth, where it's, you can essentially do whatever you want. But I think
they call that FU money.
Right, indeed. But even like, I would imagine like both of us on this call, it's like you have the resources to do stupid stuff, but you just don't do it anyway. I don't think that changes like when your resources increase, but for some reason you have this idea in the back of your mind, it's going to solve your problems. It could definitely make your life easier. I think he says money will solve your money problems
completely. Yeah, not all problems about money. Yeah, actually, this morning, we're about to put, after we finish this recording, the episode with the co-founder Square, who's a billionaire. And we talked, I talked about should billionaires exist with him. And he literally just showed me his house. He's like, does this look like a billionaire's house? He's wearing like a Square t-shirt. And he was like, it doesn't solve your problems, man. Like, I mean, and I don't want to spoil it if people haven't heard it, but even at the end, he talked about his mum committing suicide. Like, it was one of the last things we talked about. And I was like, man, like, you could listen to that for an hour long and be like, oh, this guy's got everything in the world. He doesn't need. And then you hear that and you're like, man, this guy's gone through more than, like, I haven't had to go through that, thankfully. And I'm not a billionaire, but, you know, I might be as sane and comfortable as him in a way because I haven't had to go through that trauma, you know what I mean? So anyway, that's
you trade every penny to avoid a situation like that.
Exactly,
sure.
Man. But yeah, man, listen, this has been amazing, man. Like, I know you don't always do it this long, and I really appreciate you taking the time to, like, you know, we've talked for almost 2 hours. And if you're listening to this for the first time, make sure you're subscribed on your podcast app and youtube.com/creatorlabfm. Is there anywhere we want to send people? Obviously, Visualize Value on Twitter and Instagram.
Jack Butcher on Twitter. That's, yeah. Oh, and buy this book as well. We didn't talk about this.
Yeah, we didn't. Yeah, I just bought this. So, and you actually did some illustrations for it, right?
Did a few drawings in here, yeah. But Eric Georgensen, you should get him on if you haven't got
that
plan.
Yeah, I was speaking to him on Twitter. Amazing.
He compiled this this incredible book of all the stuff that Naval's put out publicly. Tim Ferriss wrote the foreword in this thing. It's really cool.
That's a cool project, man. That must have been really cool.
I loved it.
It's like coming full circle from how it started for you.
Exactly, yeah. I think that's kind of a great story. I was going to make a video about that. I just reached out in a DM to Eric on Twitter. I was like, I've been doing these things.
Oh, no way.
Would you be up for it? Yeah, no, I initiated it and it happened eventually. So it's a good example of working in public and,
man, I love it.
Just adding value where you can.
Well, that's a great way to leave this, man. I appreciate the time. And, man, when you're back in New York, or I mean, well, you've moved now, so whenever we're in the same place, we need to definitely hang out. And yeah, this has been sick, man. I know people are going to really enjoy this one, I think.
I appreciate it, man. It was a great chat. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. I'll have an episode for you every week. These are raw, uncut, and actionable conversations with the greatest business minds and creators in the world. So make sure you're subscribed. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, BZAIDI, or CreatorLabFM on any other channel. I really appreciate it. Helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.